I have a...
It's a sort of legacy meaning.
Good evening. Welcome. My name is Natalie Turvey. I'm Executive Director of the Canadian Journalism Foundation. And warm welcome to you, and thank you for joining us on this soggy evening for our CJFJ talk on the role and future of public broadcasters in the media ecosystem, both here and abroad. I'd like to thank those who make our events possible, BMO Financial Group, our exclusive series sponsor, and our thanks to CNW, our in-kind supporter this evening. If you'd like to join tonight's conversation on Twitter, you can do that using the hashtag CJFJTalk. In an increasingly fractured and competitive and crowded media environment, how can public broadcasters remain relevant, innovative news organizations? How can they attract a new generation of audiences while retaining existing ones? What is the future of the flagship news program? And how are these media organizations meeting the needs at local level? The Globe and Mail's Simon Haupt is here to explore these issues and more this evening with our panel. Simon is the Globe's senior media writer. He began his career with the Globe and Mail in 1999 as the paper's New York arts correspondent. After 10 years on the beat, he returned to the Globe's Toronto newsroom to join the Report on Business as its advertising and marketing reporter. Prior to the Globe, Simon worked on the CBC TV media current affairs show Undercurrents. He's also author of Museum of the Missing, A History of Art Theft. This is, I think, Simon's fourth J-Talk with us, so you're in great hands this evening. Please join me in welcoming your moderator, Simon Haupt.
Thank you, Natalie. I should begin by saying that in a kind of meta moment, this evening will be recorded and possibly broadcast at a later date by CBC Radio's Ideas. So they're going to be using the audio recording. During the panel discussion, if you're going to heckle, please do so loudly so it will be picked up. And obviously later with the Q&A, please speak directly into the microphone. So I'm honored to introduce this evening's esteemed panel. To my immediate left is James Harding, who joined the BBC. I'm going to read some brief biographical notes if you wish. I believe programs have been handed out. You can read the long version. And we'll see who gets there faster. James Harding joined the BBC as Director of News and Current Affairs in 2013. Prior to that appointment, James was editor of The Times for 5 years. He had joined the paper in 2006 as business and city editor. James also previously worked at the Financial Times in a variety of positions, Washington bureau chief from 2002 to 2004 as media editor, and in the late 1990s as a correspondent in China. He speaks Japanese, Chinese, French, and German. And having spoken with him for a couple of minutes, I can also say he speaks a very British English. Jennifer McGuire, to his left, has been the general manager and editor-in-chief of CBC News since 2009. She's responsible for, well, pretty much everything you see. CBC News Network, all news programming on CBC television and radio, cbcnews.ca, and all digital and mobile applications of CBC News. Previously, she was executive director of CBC Radio, and before that, executive director of programming for CBC Radio. Shows created under her include The Current, Q, and Wiretap, and she speaks English.
And some French.
And some French. And a special bureaucratic dialect known as CBCEs, which is basically...
Off limits tonight.
There will be a bit of it. We had a conversation earlier and she kept saying platform. So anyway, that language is all but impenetrable to outsiders. You'll hear some of that, though. Michael, a.k.a. Mike Oreskes. There we
That's
go.
That's fine.
Thank you.
That's fine. Platform was a reference to Union Station.
Yeah.
Am I right, your breath?
Is Mike Oreskes is NPR's senior vice president of news and editorial director. Now you will see he looks very young, but his biography says he has about 40 years of professional journalism experience, ranging from reporter to senior managing editor, and he has expertise in shepherding the transition of traditional media to multimedia enterprises. He joined NPR in 2015 after 7 years with the Associated Press. He's also served as executive editor of the International Herald Tribune and a series of roles at the New York Times, including deputy managing editor, Washington bureau chief, chief political correspondent, and city editor, Now, as I say, firmly ensconced at NPR, he speaks fluent tote bag and coffee mug.
As well as New York.
As well as,
yeah, speak. Yes. Excellent New York.
So I don't want to spend too much time on this particular question, but when it comes to public broadcasting or newscasting, certainly when there are other people in the room who work for commercial operations, private operations, we need to begin with funding and the model. So if you could briefly give me a sense, James, of BBC's model and funding. I believe you have something like £100 billion a year.
He has what everybody wants.
A divine power of prayer. Sort of new readers to the BBC, the way it works is that the BBC is funded by a license fee. I know many people in the room will know this. If you own a television, or in fact a radio of old, but a television, the requirement is that each household pays £145.50. That means that the BBC overall has a revenue of just about £3.5 billion a year.
Okay. And of that, how much do you get to spend?
So it's split between fun things and not fun things. So sex and dancing, aka drama and entertainment, that is nothing to do with, unfortunately, my bit of it. I do wars and budgets. And unfortunately, in the world that we live in, actually wars, budgets, and elections, I think if you speak to my colleagues on the financial side, we're spending more than we should because it's been quite a busy time. But so there's a sort of general portion of that, which is split three ways. We spend a certain amount on the BBC World Service, which is in news. That's currently 29 language services, but moving to 40. Then there's effectively a local radio network, which is about 40-odd radio stations and regional television stations in the UK. And then there's the network, what you think of the BBC. So the nightly news, breakfast news, radio programs, current affairs, films, and radio docs. So that's it in totality.
And I'm sorry, did I hear a particular number for you?
You didn't.
and would you want to give me a ballpark?
I'll tell you the reason why. Just to be clear, what we've always tended to do is talk about it in its totality, and we're always quite careful just about how we discuss the exact funding of news versus drama versus entertainment. If you look in the annual report, you'll see the percentage that is news. You'll see the percentage of drama and entertainment, but we was a little bit coy on the exact number.
All right. Jennifer, would you like to...
Maybe I'll be brief because I'm assuming most people in the room are familiar with the CBC, but we're a mixed model. We have an appropriation from the government, and we're also commercial on some of our platforms. Radio is commercial-free. Digital, we're commercial, and television, we're commercial as well.
And roughly how much of that... let's just talk about the government appropriation, which is roughly $1 billion. For all of CBC, which includes everything that you guys do, the sex and entertainment.
Yes, so it's the same. The way it gets allocated between what is news proper and radio, it's a bit complicated. So
why is it complicated, Jennifer?
Just in terms of where the departments go up, but I'll say the same thing as James. If you look in our annual report, you'll see how it gets distributed.
Could somebody, while we're here, yeah, Google the annual reports of these? Because I know that it's interesting when these people spend their lives asking for kind of answers, and it would be great if one of you could find the answer.
The answer, anyway. I bet you will. That'll show us.
Mike, I think your numbers are relatively transparent.
I even pointed them out to you.
Yeah. Right. So why don't you point them out to
us? So the public media in the United States obviously is a quite different structure, and it all operates under a law which is actually now 50 years old this year, which is the Public Broadcasting Act, which was one of Lyndon Johnson's great society measures, one of the lesser noticed, but quite important. And that law empowered two things. One is it created a set of unified licensing for both television and radio broadcasters, non-commercial licenses. So the requirement of the license, these were previously educational broadcasters, there's some religious broadcasters in this category. But fundamentally, it created what ended up becoming a network of both television and radio stations operating under these non-commercial licenses. They then created what is now NPR. So NPR was actually created by these stations as a way of providing national and global programming, most of it news programming. Most of what we do is journalism, not entirely, we can talk about that. And the system overall gets a certain amount, under the Public Broadcasting Act, there's a private but government-funded corporation called the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and they get about $450 million a year from the federal government, from Congress. And that money is divided up, I won't even comment on my view of the fairness of how it's divided up, but about $100 million of that $450 million ends up in the hands of public radio. So that $100 million represents about 10% of the cost of running public radio in the United States. The totality of all of public radio is probably about a $1 billion business, more, you know, rough justice, of which we are about 20%. We, NPR, we're about $200 million. Right. And the only question I can't actually answer, but I could try to look it up and figure it out. So we put as much of our $200 million as we possibly can into content. Not all of it is news, but we certainly put a lot of it into news. And then all of the stations put money into news as well. So the totality of what we spend on journalism, it could be $400-500 million, I would guess. But I'm actually guessing. I don't know. We've never actually tallied it up. I can tell you how many people there are, but I can't tell you actually the numbers for what's going into content. Because it is, each of these is an individual organization. They're each separately licensed, separately owned, separately run companies. And we have created this network out of that, and so each of them is an individual business, and we pretty much know what's going on, but it's not one organization. It's actually literally a network in the most literal sense of the word.
And government funding is, at the moment, relatively stable. We'll see what happens with the budget.
Correct. The president has proposed to eliminate it. Right. That's before Congress now. We've been down this road a few times before, and each time Congress, which has generally been quite supportive of public media, has continued the funding. So, you know, beyond that, we don't really know. You know, our stations are very major players in their communities all over the country. They do a lot of local journalism and a lot of other local programming. It's a major, and it's become increasingly important because as other providers of news and information in local communities have run on the rocks, our stations have greatly expanded the amount of journalism they do. There's probably more or less about 500 more journalists working in public radio today than there were 5 years ago. And almost all of that, a little bit of that is NPR, but most of that is actually local news. And so they've been filling a void that's been created by the decline of local broadcasting and local newspapers. And so there's a lot of support in these communities for these stations. And that's where the decisions really get made, individual senators and congressmen.
All right, so that gets at, frankly, one of the core issues, one could say questions, but certainly sometimes in Houses of Parliament, issues about public broadcasting. That is to say, whether you are skewing the marketplace, whether you are complementary to the privates or commercial broadcasters, what your role is. James, you've obviously, prior to coming to the BBC, you were on the dark side at the Times and Financial Times. Did you, if you can recall, at that time when you were raising the flag for capitalism, see BBC as something that was distorting the market?
So look, I mean, I think everyone who's been in on the public broadcasting side, particularly since the move online, has been around this debate, right? And the argument is, particularly since the move online, is that newspapers feel as though they're being crowded out, particularly commercially, by the availability of public service broadcasters operating online. The argument that I made when I joined the BBC, and the argument that seemed to me was the case when I was at the Times and the FT too, was the real question was around advertising. Now, it's obviously slightly different in each case between BBC, CBC, and NPR. But my starting point is always, if you think about what is happening in terms of online and digital advertising, if you think about what Google did over time to to classified ads that were such a part of newspapers. And if you look at what Facebook has done more recently to advertising generally, then I start with a simple question. If you wiped us out, if you just removed the BBC, you removed CBC, you removed NPR, would it be the case that that would make a meaningful difference to the business model of any of those print publications? And the answer when you go and speak to them and you speak to the ad sales teams is no. The issue is fundamentally around the changes in the advertising model digitally. So I think that the argument around public service broadcasters is not about distortions of the market. It's about whether or not public service broadcasters are delivering what they're being asked to do in terms of giving the best of everything to everyone. It's about that universality element that's really key, particularly in this digital age. But no, I don't buy the argument. I think we've got to be very wary because we're big operators. You know, as I sort of laid out, the BBC is a big operator. But no, I don't buy the idea of this this big distortion to the market, particularly in journalism. In journalism, actually, I think more than anything, we're complementary, and when we're at our best, we're competitive.
Well, you may say you're complementary, but you know, a couple years ago, or perhaps it was last year, you authored the report "The Future of News," in which you argued that there was a collapse locally in local news around the UK, and that the BBC should rush in and fill the voids that were left by the collapse. But of course, I believe it was the News Media Association pushed back and said, "Whoa, hold on a second. We're vibrant. We're doing just fine. Stay out of, you know, get off our turf."
Well, actually, to be fair, I didn't say that. What I said was, look, we live in a time where you're seeing, certainly in the UK, and obviously this is something that's been a long time coming in Canada and the US too. But in the UK, you're seeing really significant devolution of power. So you're seeing much more powerful local mayors, much more powerful local city councils, public services. And at the same time, because of the changes in the business model around news, you are seeing significant reductions in those newsrooms. And is there a genuine risk that citizens of our countries are being asked to make decisions without having the information they need about the running of their public services and public institutions? And so actually what we did was we got together with the local papers and said, look, everyone is talking down local journalism. Actually, we're witnessing a revival of local journalism. We're seeing, whether or not it's in print or digital or in film and audio, we're seeing an extraordinary renaissance in local journalism. What are we going to do, though, about this really gritty business of covering public services and institutions? And actually, fun enough, together with the NMA, we got together and said, actually, is there a way that we could do something that looks at those democratic institutions and provides great journalism both for the BBC and for those newspapers and those other newsrooms? And we've just started, we've had a run, a couple of pilots, and actually it's been really impressive because we've unearthed stories. In the end, this is about the stories that you deliver. In the northeast of England, this first pilot has shown really interesting stories about fetal alcohol syndrome, things that were just not being reported. And so it is actually an example, surprisingly enough, of ways in which you can be complementary.
You know, I think the experience of the United States is instructive in this in an interesting way, and it's interesting how, in the end, we've sort of, I think NPR and the BBC have ended up in very similar places from opposite directions. And if you go back to that Public Broadcasting Act, it was very clear about the mission that was being given to public broadcasters. The language of the law is actually quite, and of Johnson's approval message is very clear. It's the purpose of public broadcasting in the United States was to fill needs unmet by commercial broadcasters. Mm-hmm. It was totally clear. In those days, the need they worried about was what Newton Minow called the vast wasteland of television in the United States, which, thinking back to those glorious days, you know, basically three television networks, and most of what they ran was crap. Mm-hmm. And so they were thinking about television entertainment or television. They weren't thinking about news, and they weren't thinking about radio, by the way. And what's fascinating now is we live in an age where, you know, it's a golden age of television drama, of television entertainment, of television, all sorts of television programming. But the great unmet need, certainly in the United States, and I think similarly in Canada and the United Kingdom, is robust, independent, sustainable journalism. And that's become a real crisis, particularly at the local level. If you look at what's happened in the United States, there's been an enormous disinvestment in local journalism. You know, the big national organizations are still strong. They've gone up and down and done things. But the place where it is really calamitous is local journalism, covering city hall and state legislatures.
And it's odd because any bit of research about sort of news consumers' wants and needs shows a clear sort of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, and local tends to be really at the top. It matters.
Maslow's hierarchy. I missed that part. Local news covering the mayor.
No, it's true. You know what? This is one of the things. You know, I'm, as you said, I'm a newcomer, relatively speaking, to the BBC. And when I arrived, you know, you asked people, right? Well, just how are these shows doing? How those are. Our system is that we have a 6 o'clock national news bulletin, runs for half an hour, and then 6:30 to 7. Now, every day, the most popular program, regularly, not always, but regularly on BBC One, is that 6:30 to 7 local half hour of news. That's where there's an enormous appetite. And I think it's often underestimated by people. It's hugely, hugely popular in the UK.
And certainly in the CBC experience, everybody talks about the strength of CBC Radio, and anybody with connections to CBC Radio will herald the strength of local. It's built on the strength of local.
They're going to herald the strength of local radio. I'm not sure they're going to say, I tune in every evening to CBC Toronto at 6:30.
That's right, the supper hour news. Not the same story, for sure.
Right, and frankly, a number of the stations across. I don't want to dwell on that, but that's a very different story.
That's right.
Although I think one of the challenges all of us face is how to get past which delivery system we're using to the fundamental issue of how are we getting the information that communities need to do their work, to be democracies, to avoid the traffic, whatever your need is as a citizen. How are we getting it to them? And it isn't about radio versus television versus digital versus Twitter.
Don't say the P word yet. I'm not going to the P word yet.
I'm stopped.
I mean, in the case of CBC, it's been a deliberate push towards digital and mobile,
right,
locally.
Right. Jennifer, can you, because I think we sort of missed you in that question. I know there's a question you answer frequently, but are you guys skewing the market? Do you see it as that?
No, I would say we see ourselves as, obviously a big player in the market, and we're successful, but we see ourselves as complementary. Now we're in the
even on digital, and I'm not sure if my publisher is here, but
yes,
that's there. there are some.
Yes,
he's just the editor. He's not concerned about the business
issues.
So
I mean, I've said it before. The ad revenue connected to CBC News that's attributed to digital is relatively small in terms of our overall ad revenue.
Right. So why not just get rid of it? Why not say, you know what, $20 million?
CBC has a proposal out there right now to have CBC go ad-free across the board. It would require some investment to replace lost revenue and replace some of the time that the advertising takes. But, I think the estimation is, and my colleagues will correct me if I get the number wrong, it would put potentially $158 million back into the market for other broadcasters, but it would require some investment at the front end. But the other thing it does for the public broadcaster is it actually it gives sort of clarity of purpose of what the game is, right? And certainly we saw with the radio revolution when CBC Radio, which used to have advertising on it, if you guys remember back to the 70s, I guess, is when the switch happened, it actually created a programming revolution because people weren't dealing with their programming in blocks anymore. It opened up a real opportunity to think about things in a different way. I think the same would be true in the context of CBC News on television and other platforms, but it's not a realistic model without investment.
Okay, can we just stop there for a second and ask, kind of blue sky that out for me. I mean, if CBC were to get 318 or 350 or whatever it is, and I know obviously CBC News doesn't get all of that. Some go to the fine folks at Ideas. but like, what does that? What kind of a difference? A fundamental difference does that make for you? Does that mean you can have 10 anchors of the new national?
There's the loaded question. I just think it changes the way you program. We have obligations to hit commercial breaks at certain times in programs like the national, and it changes what you program in between them. You could do longer form things. You could do different kinds of treatments. And certainly, we don't make editorial choices based on, you know, clickbaits contrary to popular beliefs. You know, our Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women series, it was not an audience driver, but it was a really important piece of public service journalism. So it doesn't frame us editorial, but the treatments that we could do in an open environment without hitting commercial breaks would be different, absolutely.
Okay. It's worth noting, you know, there's a trend worth noting here which has huge impact on us, maybe not so much, but it does change the conversation, which is, you know, from our perspective in public media in the United States, we feel that the change in the media industry is actually bringing commercial media much more into line with our approach. I mean, we've been in the subscription business fundamentally for 45 years. Yes, we give tote bags in exchange, but fundamentally, we collect revenue from listeners and use it as that's our single largest source of revenue.
But they have to re-up every
every chance we get. I mean, as often as possible.
Yes,
I'm sorry, I forgot to bring you your mug.
I have seven already. It's fine.
But in other words, I view this as a citizen, as a good thing, which is that the decline in the advertising business and the disruption of the advertising business, and we should come back to discussing Facebook and Google, has brought the newspapers much more in line with our approach, which is a much greater reliance on the individual user. And the proportion of revenue that's now coming from subscribers to newspaper businesses, newspaper and digital businesses, you know, is much closer to what had been true in Europe, much closer to our proportions now, and the proportion that's dependent on advertising is steadily declining. So this whole debate gets changed by that. In our case, it gets changed a lot. We think they're muscling in on us, frankly. It's,
you know. Speaking of muscling, go ahead.
I was just going to say one thing, just to your original question, Simon, about the kind of distortion. Of course big broadcasters can distort markets. Of course they can. And we've got to be vigilant about that and wary of it. But it's also important to remember they can also distort markets for the better.
That's right.
So one of the things that when you look at the BBC's impact is the BBC, because it is such a big commissioner of filmmaking, of programming, of natural history documentaries, of long-form current affairs films, is it creates a hub, and it's been a hub that's been a very powerful part of not only the cultural, you know, sorry, I hate this phrase, cultural fabric of the country, but also the economy. So I think there's an argument which does sit around CBC as well, which you've also got to assess, which is, does a big investment in CBC, yes, enable other parts, independent filmmakers, producers, other services to grow around that? So, you know, I think the way in which we often talk about this is actually rooted in an argument that began, if you like, sort of mid-90s and probably should have ended about a decade ago, which is all around an old form of the advertising market. That world's moved on. Actually, these investments in these big cultural powerhouses is economically very powerful. So I do think there are distortions that are for the better.
So I mean, essentially, you're the Hewlett Packard around which Silicon Valley is created.
Well, if you look, I mean, you know, that'd be very nice. But if you look at look at countries, look at economies where they have big creative industries, there are hubs, right? And there are hubs that are extremely powerful, and they have impacts beyond the obvious ones. So Hollywood has an impact that now slips into a lot of technology around VR, around gaming. I think if you looked at the BBC and the impact on the cultural industries, what you'd hear from people is it's not just what you commission, but it's the experience and the talent that brings. So yes, I think that everyone now sees that those things, if you can build really powerful clusters in those sectors, they have a big impact in your national economy and internationally too.
And I believe that's part of CBC's argument,
that's
right?
That's right.
At least over the past year, I've started to hear that.
Yes, certainly the assessment that CBC has done in terms of creating a Creative Canada, like the Creative Britain idea, would see economic growth.
Okay.
I do think you have to see this in the context of now and the next few years, not the context of the past, which is whatever fights and debates and arguments we may have with our commercial colleagues, we are in one leaky boat together with them on the really big question, which is where will the public's information come from in the years ahead? And will we, and I mean we journalism, we creators of information, will we be able to provide reliable, robust, independent information in a world that's heavily controlled by these platform companies? And I'm not trying to create some, you know, paranoid situation, but the reality is that is the issue for all of us. And the whatever amount of competition goes on between us and a commercial provider of similar kinds of content, it pales in comparison to the question of whether any of us can reach audiences with valuable and reliable information in a world where most of that information is mediated through tech companies. And it's who have taken so far, I mean, the world can change, but up to today, they have taken no responsibility for the quality or the impact of that information, a thing we all consider to be part of our day job.
And it's just reframing, how do we make everybody stronger than the tit for tat?
Okay, before we get to how to make everybody stronger and take back some power from Mr. Zuckerberg. James, I mean, you guys don't see each other as competitors, right? Of each other, no? Presumably?
Well, I mean, the BBC is in Canada digitally, of
right.
course.
Right, so, yes. So what's that about? Why are you mowing her lawn?
Actually, we're mowing his lawn.
Oh, all right. No. Go ahead. So, because BBC Canada did launch, I think you've got all three employees.
Can I say this? The first time I've had one of these really great expressions come. What does that mean? Does that mean, because it seems to me, if I'm mowing her lawn, that is a pure piece of public service, isn't it? I mean, I'm just here showing up, getting unpaid, helping with your gardening. Exactly. Is that what that means?
Or does it mean? But you're taking the grass away. And
oh, I see. Oh, I see. I see. Okay.
I grew up in New York. What's a lawn?
Okay, right. So. What do you mean? Sort of, what's the nature of competition between the public service broadcasters?
No, I'm just curious why BBC Canada? That's all. BBC.
Why are we here? Yeah. Well, because the BBC is a global news operation.
Sure, but you're.
We're trying to reach English language audiences everywhere, and that's part of the world service.
Well, why?
Mission.
I mean, why? I'm not paying a license fee. Why should I benefit from my great aunt? In Sussex, paying her TV license fee.
Well, firstly, pass on my thanks.
She's cut the cord. She's just answering.
So when I, you're right, when I was at the FT and when I was at the Times, one of the things about panels of people talking about public service broadcasting was I was always amazed by the speed to which they would reach for being worthy. And they suddenly start talking in these incredibly high-minded moral ways. And now I'm afraid I'm going to do the same thing. So if you go back and you look at where it started, 1922 at the BBC, there was this notion, wasn't there, that nation shall speak peace unto nation, and the World Service was created as an expression of that same idea. I don't think that we should be embarrassed or apologetic about the idea of trying to provide, as far as possible, each of us in our different ways, new services that reach audiences everywhere. In fact, the thing that I think is incredibly exciting about the times we live in is that more than ever, I can listen to NPR, or I can check in on the news from CBC. That seems to me to be a great and happy thing. And, given how few things you can, get for free, I think if you can get the BBC and look at it online, I think that's a good thing.
And I mean, the CBC does the same thing. We're distributed on public radio mm-hmm. in the US, our radio programs, and we have a world service as well through Radio Canada.
But by the way, just one thing yes. to remember is, I know we keep on sort of teetering towards this conversation about the big tech companies. Our thoughts about our numbers are big by comparison with some, but nothing by comparison with those tech numbers. So we've set ourselves an ambition of reaching a global audience of 500 million, which when we set it seemed like an ambitious target. That's still small by comparison with the numbers of those large tech operators.
And I saw some numbers yesterday. You're 15th worldwide, is it now or? Never mind.
I don't know. Okay. I mean, I don't know which survey
right.
that is.
Fair enough. All right. So I should tell you that a couple of weeks ago, I had some calls, some pre-calls with James, a pre-call with James, and one with Jennifer and Mike, and I went in and I said, look, the great thing about public broadcasters is that as the privates are all kind of desperately looking for some kind of model to keep the lights on. Financial model to keep the lights on, public broadcasters, in the case of BBC, has just received an 11-year charter. CBC is, just received another 135 million, I believe, annually. And at least at the moment, NPR has not been cut. So that's good.
We got a new creative coffee mugs in.
But there, and maybe 'twas ever thus, it seemed to me that they were each facing some sort of existential challenge. And that was kind of my beginning position when I started the conversation. And of course, one by one, they were all, you're absolutely wrong. We're stronger than ever. We're recommitted to our mission. You know, as the privates all die away, we're going to carry the banner of truth and the lifeblood of democracy. And that's great. However, there are some challenges. And I believe, Mike, you were the first to mention this.
Oh, yeah.
What is your primary challenge?
So, and we did have this conversation, so this portion of the programming has been pre-rehearsed.
Oh, no, I got some new questions.
Good. Yeah.
But it's actually it's important. So there's, I actually think existentially we know exactly what we're trying to do, but we have an enormous execution challenge. And what in the United States what that challenge is kind of grows out of what I described at the beginning about how we grew up. We grew up at this kind of confederation of loosely connected organizations, each of whom had their own definition of what journalism should be and what programming should be and what their community should be. And we've come to the conclusion that we've reached a scale and an influence in the ecosystem, I hate that word, but in the ecosystem of news in the United States, we've become so influential that we actually need to pull it together and become a much more integrated network. So we're working very closely with our station network now to tie ourselves together in a way that actually allows us to support their local journalism much more robustly, to have them be really the contributors to the way we cover the United States in a way that allows us to be everywhere in the country, which no other provider of news in the United States really is capable of doing, and we've seen why that matters so much in recent times. And to get from where we are today to where we're gonna be, where we hope to be, I don't think it's philosophic, and as I think we see what it should be, so in that sense it's not existential, it's practical. It's can we pull that off? Can we win the support of our public, which is not so much the federal government as, you know, those millions of people out there who are our listeners and therefore our supporters. Can we continue to build that? Can we continue to, it's been growing dramatically over the last few years, and can we continue to make that happen so that those people will then support the work we're trying to do to build this system? And that's a big task.
Let me just go down the rabbit hole for a second. What do you mean you support these small states? I mean, how do you support them with expertise?
So, for example, we might have 3 or 4 or 5 stations in a state. We're very much encouraging them to network themselves together, to work together to cover their state government, their state legislature, to figure out how they can invest in local investigative reporting. We do a lot of their training for them. We help them build these things. We don't have the same sort of culture up and down the system the way the BBC or the CBC would. And so we need to build all of that, which is a task. We have benefited a lot by the many newspaper journalists who actually have lost their jobs or decided to leave troubled newspapers. And we've hired a lot of them to help us do this, in fact. But it's a big project to build newsrooms all over the country to do this work. And we're in the middle of that. And you know, and it's one of those things you can't stop in the middle. You either get it done, or you don't make it. And so, in that sense, I suppose it's existential. You get it done, and then you've got something the country is gonna want because the service that it provides is both essential and unique. There's just not another service like that. But if you stop in the middle, you're just one of a whole bunch of people trying to do it.
And what I would say, 150 million sounds like a lot, but at the end of the day, with the cuts that have happened to CBC over the years, we're still sort of behind. I think we're the third worst funded public broadcaster in the world.
I'm not sure where you're the bottom.
Where we have been aggressive is really looking at how we work pulling on the capacity we have across the various things that CBC does, and looking at how we organize work in a different way to create capacity to invest in investigative journalism. Right now, CBC has 70 dedicated investigative journalists across the country and within our programming, which is much higher than the so-called heyday of CBC, and that came by really redirecting resources, because the overall pot has decreased. So capacity and the ability to be true to your values across these new environments that you're programming into, I think, is part of what we every day talk about as a team. How do we do it in a way that is meaningful? How do we compete in terms of relevance? And relevance not only for the Canadians who use our existing platforms who tend to be older, but that next generation who is only consuming their content digitally. How do they get access to public media that they are a part of and deserve to be part of?
All right, so we'll get to the next generation in a sec. But let me ask you, how do you justify, 70 investigative reporters when, for example, you're cutting, half of the staff, which is to say, two people in a northern community afternoon radio show?
So we've made hard decisions across the board, and if resources were open-ended, we wouldn't have to say our priority is here and here's where we're investing at this point. But we've had to make really hard decisions. When we made the shift to local digital last year, we pulled significant money out of local markets across the country, particularly in television. And it was a choice to say, okay, we now know this is where we have to invest.
Right, I don't want to sound disrespectful. So I know what you've done.
Yeah.
Give me the justification.
The justification is looking at where we are positioning ourselves to where the audience is going and making our strategies around these things audience first. So we didn't, we have obligations around local television and we're fulfilling our obligations, but we're looking at where the audience is consuming content, and we were under-resourced in that area, and that's where we decided to invest.
And the investigative stuff piece, obviously, because you feel?
Well, we see ourselves as having a leadership role in terms of investigative and enterprise journalism, and we've had a banner year on that front, whether it's our Go Public or Marketplace, or Fifth Estate, or our investigative content units. So we see that as part of our role as a public service broadcaster.
James, challenges?
Okay, well,
I know, how to spend the money, right?
No, firstly, just to pick up on a couple of things that Jennifer said, and I think we should be clear. I remember when I arrived at the BBC, someone said to me, what's your strategy? And I looked rather blankly at them, and I was like, what do you mean, what's your strategy? How about just going to get some stories? And to a certain extent, the biggest challenge is what we're facing in the news, right? And we shouldn't overlook just the scale of how complicated the thing is that our newsrooms are trying to deal with. So if you look globally, you're dealing with very fragmented and very difficult sets of insecurity and threat. So you're not talking about one kind of war in one kind of place. You're talking about very, very significant and different kinds of threats to teams of journalists who are doing extremely brave and important work. That of itself is a really serious challenge. Domestically, you've got what I think of as a really significant problem: scandals in plain sight, where you are looking at a certain kind of story where patterns of behavior have become normal, but you're walking past them. And actually taking the time to investigate what's happening in some of, and this is not necessarily, it can be public institutions, it can be private businesses, having the time to do that when the sort of swirl of headline news, the Trump presidency, the vote for Brexit, we have a general election just been called in the UK. There's a very significant one on presidential election underway in France. So I think, I just say, we all sit and we talk about these strategic things. We shouldn't lose sight from the fact that our biggest challenge is delivering on the news. What's happening, what's really happening, and what it actually means. So that, I think, would be the biggest one. To pick up on your question about the two jobs here versus the investment there, one of the most significant challenges we've got, and we've all got it in different ways, is that everything is going very well. right? And I know that sounds glib, but the problem is if you live and you're trying to deal with falling budgets at a time where your TV bulletin audiences are holding up if not growing, where your radio audiences are holding up if not growing, where your digital audiences are growing exponentially and the different ways you can deliver digitally growing, the appetite within your newsrooms and within a creative organization for resources is absolutely extraordinary. And it's a real, really difficult set of judgments because you're seeing audiences change. And I suppose the reason why, you know, when we had that conversation, Simon, you said, look, are you facing an existential crisis? I smiled on the phone from London partly because, you know, people say the definition of a newsroom is a place where morale has never been so low. You know, the definition of a newsroom in a public service broadcaster is a place where morale has never been so low and we're facing profound questions about our future. You know, there's always that sense. But actually, what I find being at the BBC is that there is a clarity about our role in the world, about being there for quality, about being there for everybody. And actually that I find gives us real clarity. The difficulty is doing that within the resources available. That's the biggest challenge, is making those choices.
So you say you're there for everybody, and I know we do need to get back to the Facebook thing, yeah. But you've raised an interesting issue for me, which is that if you look at the diversity of your newsrooms, yeah, and Jennifer's newsrooms and Mike's, at least the studies I've seen, Mike, actually, NPR is essentially representative of the population it serves, which is to say of the population of America. You know, and perhaps it could use a bump on the Latino representation, but other than that, you're doing very well. And I'm mindful of the fact that here we are, a very diverse panel. it may be a little bit of a minefield to wander in here, but you know, Jennifer, obviously CBC has a diversity plan.
That's right.
James, the new charter, you have made a commitment to diversity. With all due respect, why has it taken till now to kind of say, oh, diversity is important? I mean, you know, you were criticized, James, not personally, but you know, BBC was criticized for, I believe, a narrow monoculture in the wake of Brexit, the sense that, you know, you missed part of the story because of the narrow monoculture in BBC. Do you cop to that, first of all? Is that true? And are you as diverse? Why are you not as diverse as perhaps you might be?
Right. I hope none of you are going anywhere this evening because we've got a lot to get through. The Brexit debate is actually something different. We can talk about that, or we can talk about just first the diversity issue. So you're absolutely right. You know, one of the questions that I think lots of people who work in the BBC, who work in the media generally, say is, look, we're here to be in touch with the people we serve, and just in terms of the groups of people in our newsrooms, we're not in touch enough with the people we serve because we don't look and sound enough like our audiences. And we're making huge efforts to change, and things are changing. If you look at the lineup on the 10 o'clock news today by comparison with 3 years ago, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, the changes are really significant. I think anyone who works in news knows that you can make those changes relatively quickly. The bigger and in many ways more profound changes across the whole of your newsroom, across the whole of your organization, takes longer but needs to happen too. I suppose, you know, we've got to be clear that we're dealing with something that is a backlog. Funnily enough, Jennifer and I were talking about it this morning and saying, you know, one of the things that's odd is you start off and you feel like you've joined an organization that's in 1992 and you work incredibly hard, and then you find you're in 1997, right? You know, you've still got a long way to go. That's important to recognize you're making progress, but you've got some way to go. I also happen to think you've got to be really clear. We've got diversity issues that go across a whole range of things. So you're talking about, you know, organizations like the BBC having a very direct and explicit conversation about race. You're talking about us making sure we have a different view around the way in which we think about the workplace for men and women, and we're talking about issues around disability, we should be the best newsroom, the best place for journalists with disabilities to come and work. But there are other things too. You know, in the UK, perhaps inevitably, there's a big question about social mobility and our newsrooms. Mm-hmm. And there's a big issue which is often overlooked, which is diversity of ideas and diversity of backgrounds. So,
because that's ultimately the issue, really.
I think they're all issues. I think if you're funded by the public, there's an issue which is, does this feel like a place that represents the country I live in and the values that this country represents? So there's something about that too, just as an open workplace. But yes, there is something about having a newsroom that feels as though it's going to be in touch with the audiences and what it needs. Just on Brexit, the truth is that there's an argument there, as you expect, post-referendum, which is works on both sides. It's slightly different to this one, so I'll sort of park it for a second.
Fair enough.
The other thing I would say, it's not only representation in terms of making sure Canada's reflected in our on-air staff and in our teams. At CBC, we're particularly focusing on leadership and trying to bring up a generation of diverse leaders. But it's also in our editorial processes. We've had and are modeling sort of training around unconscious bias. You know, newsrooms have ways of doing things and sort of shorthands around decision making, to your point, James, and it's how do you shift the perspectives around what matters in terms of the choices that you make. So we're definitely not perfect, but it's something that is front of mind in all of our teams.
We're going to start taking questions from the audience in about 5 minutes, but before we do, Mike, we did talk on that pre-call about Facebook. Mm. So I think we got a few minutes to talk about platforms. You said that you believe, well, first of all, obviously the balance of power has shifted from your perspective, I think from the perspective of all of you. James, your complaint is that you think you're doing really, really well, but you really have no idea because Facebook keeps all the data. But Mike, you seem to feel that NPR, at least public broadcasting, has a special role to play in what? Pushing back at Facebook?
Yeah.
You alone, $200 million, can push back?
Not necessarily me personally, although happy to do it if it's... I actually don't mean just NPR. I actually mean everybody up here and public media organizations that actually aren't as pressed by the commercial motivation, who can look at things slightly differently and with a public interest in mind, and I don't mean that in some glorious way, I mean in the most basic way, what's the audience service? And Facebook has its definition of audience service, and it's in that sense a very audience-focused organization, almost monomaniacally in a way, but their definition of service is quite different from mine, to be honest. And I think there is a role to play in working with them, I'm happy to put it that way, or confronting them, that public media organizations are uniquely well positioned to play, not alone, in alliance with commercial organizations. You know, I talk to colleagues at the New York Times and the Washington Post and the American television networks all the time about these issues. But we do have a voice that's a little different from theirs. I don't actually have to worry about my traffic from Facebook. It doesn't actually matter to me. It may matter in some ego sense or in some chart that are there, but it actually doesn't make any difference to my bottom line is not affected by that. So that gives me a chance to say to them things about how they're operating and how I think that affects the access that the public has to things that in my journalistic judgment, and it's my view, the public needs that they actually don't get properly through Facebook. I'll give you an example. So, and this is particularly about public radio, but it's just one of many examples. So many public radio stations in the United States have formed networks of emergency notification. And I think this is true basically in for all of us. And you know, these are very important services. It's a kind of journalism, or it's just a service. You know, if there's a hurricane coming across the prairie at you, it's really helpful to have your radio station say, you better get in the basement. Or whatever the danger is in your community, whether it's earthquakes in Los Angeles or fires or whatever. And so Facebook's decided to go into that same business. And they've created a kind of emergency check-in place in their thing. But it became apparent in the process of their doing it that they had done nothing to consult with any of the journalistic organizations that had been at this for a long time. and had a lot of knowledge about how it worked and a lot of understanding about how to be very careful about maintaining accuracy and reliability in the distribution of information, which, you know, we all get very worried about that in lots of journalistic settings. In most journalistic settings, it's about embarrassment or professionalism. In this case, it's about life and death. And if you screw that up, you can kill people. And they had not, they really hadn't done the work. And so that's a place where it's perfectly fine to have Facebook partner with us to do this, and I've made this offer to them, but they're not thinking in a public service way. They're thinking about how do they aggregate audiences into their community. And I think that's an important issue for the public. It's not a terribly significant issue to public radio in an audience sense. We're still going to be there. We're still going to provide that service when the hurricane is raking its way up the eastern seaboard and, you know, the Florida network and the South Carolina network are letting everybody know what's going on. But if Facebook starts getting in this business in a way that actually ends up confusing or creating bad information for people, that's going to create problems for the public. And I don't think that's a good idea. And I think we have a unique ability to present that issue in a way that actually a lot of commercial stations would also want to be involved in and should be involved in.
I've got a slightly different view to Mike on this, which is that I think that, strangely, the interests of advertising-funded news organizations and publicly funded news organizations are entirely aligned around the issue of data and Facebook, right? So this may seem a little bit in the weeds, but forgive me. So our mission is to try and give the best of everything to everyone, right? We're a public service broadcaster, and there are people who are never going to come to watch a nightly news bulletin. In fact, they're just not going to watch linear TV, and they may not listen to linear radio. But they are going to consume more and more of the journalism we do, of the programs we make. And they'll do that on Facebook or other platforms, not just Facebook. It's really important for us in two ways to know who they are and where they are, right? It's important for us in the sense that if we know what they're consuming and what they're not, we can do it better. We can give more of that best of everything. And the other thing is we're able to make the public argument that says, yes, 80% of people are coming to the BBC to get their news each week. But it actually turns out the numbers are higher than that. There are young people who are not captured in our existing figures. We are doing better in delivering our requirement of universality. Now, if you take that from a different perspective, from an advertising-funded perspective, you say, actually, it's really important for us as a news organization to be able to identify who our audiences are so that we can deliver advertising that's really useful, informative to them. Curiously, both, you know, we had one of those big round tables in London. I know they've done some here with Facebook. It was really interesting. In that room, the interest was absolutely aligned between organizations like the BBC, the FT, European newspapers too. All of us are interested in one thing. We're interested in getting a better understanding of what audiences on Facebook are consuming of our work, chiefly so that we can do it better and make sure that we're delivering to the audiences, whether advertising funded or publicly funded, that we promise to serve.
But I think certainly all of us view social platforms as part of our strategy, but owned and operated is equally as important.
Yeah.
So if anybody wants to make their way to the microphone, I'm going to ask a question I know nobody's interested in. Jennifer, what's the National going to look like in a few months?
I knew that one was coming. It's going to be different. That's the headline. I'll tell you the question we've been grappling with. At the end of the day, when the National was conceived, you would find out your news at the end of the day. We now live in a continuous news environment, so the question we've been sort of talking about as a team is, what do you need at the end of the day in a continuous news environment? So we will shift things. I think you'll see us look forward more than sort of validating the day that was. It'll have a digital play that is different from what it's doing now.
See, you just used one of those words, digital play. Can you?
So the National has a significant audience digitally, but it's really through distributing the program.
Like YouTube the next day kind of thing?
And, you know, we do Facebook Live. We do, you know, we're on YouTube. We do different things with the show. But we in the future, you'll see the team at the National create digital content in a different kind of way.
And distribute it through the day.
That's right.
Right. So do people actually, well, I shouldn't say this because CTV has shown that people apparently do still need stuff at the end of the day. Do you believe that people still need?
Absolutely.
Something like, I mean, I know James obviously, you know, his folks tell us stuff at 6:30, but you know, that's not the end of the day. By 10 o'clock, I mean, don't we know everything already?
You'll always have an original sort of enterprise, you know, pieces that are yours and proprietary, but I think that what they're looking for at the end of the day is not necessarily touching a story in the same way that they've heard all day. So you know, I think you'll see us position it differently a little bit editorially. I think the obviously we're looking at format and host will change or hosts. So all of that will be new.
By the way, I commend you for using at the end of the day literally, because you know, at the end of the day. Yes, please.
Hi, thank you so much. I wanted to talk a little bit more about that diversity issue. I'm a person of color. I'm born and raised in Canada, and I work in the documentary film world, and I'm also an activist. I think there's a lot of us who can't stand that word anymore, where people of color were First Nations, were like, stop it with the inclusion, the diversity. This is about structural inequality, this is about anti-racism, this is about anti-oppression. So it also turns out that First Nations people, Indigenous people, people of color, our stories are often some of the most critical stories in the news. Immigration, refugees, missing and murdered Indigenous women, the list goes on and on, Islamophobia. I'm wondering to what degree in each of your organizations, anti-racism, anti-oppression, in terms of how you're telling stories, from whose angle you're telling them, to what audience have you chosen as your primary audience for that story, who is in leadership at your organizations, et cetera. How much are these conversations really getting going now? Because believe me, there's a lot of us networked in this field who are people of color and Indigenous people who are starting to strategize around how to push even harder. So I'd be very curious. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So we have an Indigenous content unit, and we have a digital space for all the programming that we do across CBC, not just in news. But we've also made reflection of some of the stories and issues, like missing and murdered Indigenous women, a priority for the news service overall. So the data project that CBC drove last year, that was the Missing Murdered Indigenous Woman database and updating the stories, the Alberta Williams podcast, that is a deliberate editorial strategy that we have been really aggressive in terms of pursuing, and we've just greenlit another podcast that Connie Walker will do this year that will take another story and hopefully have the same kind of result that we did with the Alberta Williams story. So it is definitely a priority. In terms of leadership and bringing more people from different backgrounds in, it absolutely is also a priority, but we operate in sort of a you know, a closed ecosystem. We've been cutting jobs over the last several years. It's not like we have tons of new jobs to bring in, and you know, obviously we live in a unionized environment. And so the goal is there, and we are doing it, but we're doing it in steps much smaller than we need to be. I think James' point is absolutely right. We're 10 years behind where we sort of need to be, but we're in terms of our push inside and how we're approaching it, we're being as aggressive as we can.
Can I follow up on that? You know, CBC had a notorious incident, I'm trying to think, maybe was it 18 months ago now? Maybe it was only about 12 months ago, which kind of highlighted what I think all media, well, many media in Canada experience, which is when you publish something on any First Nations issue, you are bombarded, CBC right. especially, it seems to me, bombarded with the most horrible comments.
Yes.
And for a time you had to close comments. I'm curious to know, with that in mind,
right.
how you think about what the questioner asked, which is who your audience is. Because obviously those who, at least right. on the CBC sites, who were consuming many of these stories, and maybe they were just a small right. sliver of those consuming and they're just very vocal. But you know, these folks clearly were right. Horrific, hateful individuals.
Yes. I mean, there are certain stories that bring out ugliness. And we've had to close comments on, you know, generally the Middle East and some, you know, indigenous stories and other things that sort of seem to generate crazy comments. Doesn't mean it stops us from doing it or seeing it as part of our obligation and audience. You know, we don't just program stories that will, you know, be sort of mass appeal. We have an obligation to sort of tell the stories of this country and drive journalism in important places, and we see that as part of the obligation. But you can't allow people to incite hate, and that's where we sort of come down quite hard.
Do you think about audience, about who you're telling
yes,
it for?
Yes, we absolutely. We split up our audience. I can tell you what audiences consume, you know, what on different platforms. We look at cities, we look at the country overall. But like James said, we're really striving for a broad base. I think, you know, if you ask me what is the biggest challenge for the public broadcaster is making sure that we're relevant to the next generation of Canadians. And that is why you see, you know, me in particular be very aggressive about our digital play. You know, it's sort of counterintuitive because everybody thinks of Vice as the millennial brand, but CBC digitally reaches 52% of millennials in this country. You wouldn't know that, but it's true. And we have a significant younger audience digitally. We're not migrating them to the other platforms in the way that you would hope, but that's not where they're consuming news.
So first of all, thank you for your question, because I think it's actually an extremely important question for all of us globally, and I won't pretend to understand the context of your versions in Canada of this, but you know, we've been facing a couple of very important topics which make it clear that what you're asking about is both an internal question for media organizations and an external societal question. And to me, it's come down in a lot of ways to our inability to talk to each other, that there's a fundamental problem. And we've actually, I'm not sure if this is quite fully captures it, but we've gone through a very interesting and quite provocative internal discussion at NPR about a sense that many of us have, that we're moving into a different era where it's not even any longer about diversity in the old-fashioned way we thought about it. It's not just about counting up heads. It's much more about the inclusion in the key conversations. And that you can be very successful in diversity and still fail in the goal of producing the things that actually are meaningful to society. And we've had to look at ourselves and say, you know, that's happening sometimes. I mean, I think we've done well in many cases, but not always. And we so internally, I mean, the internal part of that is has been quite fascinating, actually, to take apart how we run our meetings, who's in charge of what, who gets to be listened to and who doesn't, what it feels like to be a 24-year-old in our organization versus a 55-year-old, because, you know, even for us, where we haven't been shrinking, so we don't have the excuse of that we're shrinking, we do have, obviously, an organization with lots of people who've been there for many years, and then lots of younger people, and you know, overall, our younger group is more diverse, and they're also just more aware of more things. But what if we bring them in and then just make them sit at the table and they don't get to say anything? So we've really had to confront a lot. I won't pretend here now that we actually have all the answers, but I do think the whole conversation, at least inside our organization, has changed dramatically in the last year or two. And it's partly an internal thing. It's partly because of what we've seen internally, and it's partly because of what's been going on in the country. We're clearly, the whole country has had to face the fact that we're not talking to each other, and that people just have no idea what's going on a mile from their house. And that's a challenge which I think we as journalists, and particularly maybe we as public media, have a special role as whatever you want to call that, a convener, an aggregator, and whether that's an on-the-radio conversation or a digital gathering of different points of view, that there is a thing that needs to be done much more aggressively than we have been doing it once you realize that this isn't about the individual diversity of individual people, but the conversation. So I hear you.
Look, it's a seriously deep and important question, and I'm going to try and answer it by taking it a different direction, because I can tell you that we're working hard, and I hope you'll believe it, and I share exactly what Mike's saying about the outcomes in terms of the stories that we tell and the way in which we talk to each other. Well, I sat here this evening, and also just sort of being here through the course of the day, and I just wonder whether or not there is a question about where the debate is around CBC itself. I'm a visitor to Canada, so you can aim off me not knowing my way around this country or this media market. But if you look at a country that is changing fast, in a world that is changing in very complicated ways, there is a danger, it strikes me, that the debate is hemmed in by small bore and particular criticisms. And I wonder why, and it's genuinely a question, why there is not an argument that says something like a public broadcaster, something like a Canadian public broadcaster can stand up and tell Canada's stories and ask Canada's questions. And it can do that, but only if Canada and Canadians are willing to invest in it. Now, I recognize there's a bargain there, which is that any public service, and in this case a broadcaster, must deliver creative and editorial excellence. But if CBC stands up and delivers that, shouldn't the debate move to a different place, which is to say, actually, the investment in this public service is woefully inadequate. And it shouldn't be the case that a Canadian public service broadcaster is funded at a third of the rate that a UK public service broadcaster is funded. And the reason I say that in answer to your question is it's really important that fundamental things change. And if you want to fundamentally change an organization, doing that while you keep cutting back on what those services are, it's not just the problem of the services being cut back. You really find it incredibly hard to make the rapid changes in terms of people and outlook and engagement that you need to make to fundamentally answer your question. So the reason I say that is that if you really, I think, want to change it, forgive me, I think you're it's a really difficult position, which is you've got to campaign furiously to change the organization, to see it change, and also campaign energetically to make sure it gets the investment it needs for the future.
Believe me, the people of color and media in Canada know this. I would also say that this is a challenge to all of us in the room. We are in a city that's 50% statistically people of color. We are not in an audience that is statistically 50% people of color. So I would ask all of us collectively to embrace, including the Canadian Journalism Foundation, what would it mean that some of these talks soon are have a very different face all over? Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I just want to honor the land that we're on as First Nations. I'm proud to come from a media family, grew up going to parties with the Hindmarsh family here in Toronto. I'm a Métis Canadian Buddhist minister. I was nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize after meeting Prime Minister Pierre Trudeau and going on a 61-day fast in Ottawa. And in terms of diversity, I want to... Oh, there's Michael Volpe. How lovely.
Hi.
In 1993, I suffered a hate crime in my workplace, which, as a civil servant working with injured workers, I was told that I was not welcome to a job in my country because I'm Buddhist, because I'm Métis, because I'm female. And we have tracked the CBC's lack of stories about the Buddhist community throughout the years. And just recently, phoning up CBC and asking CBC to cover our community during the Waysak period. Waysak is the Buddhist birthday, which I was found to be celebrating in 1993 and told I was a dirty, awful, heathen, backwards Buddhist, and etc. We were told by CBC, even today, that we are not human, that our religious community does not matter. And that's like we've been waiting and waiting to be included. And I've worked really hard throughout my life, you know, campaigning for public broadcasting, being somebody from a family in the media, and a Toronto police family, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, I think it's about time CBC recognizes and includes us and goes beyond just the discussion around Islamophobia, but includes the discussion around Buddha phobia, Hindu phobia, Sikh phobia, whatever you want to call it. I'm not young, I'm not a millennial.
I'm sorry.
I'm exhausted. But can we please have CBC meet with the Buddhist community to discuss how we can make this better?
Thank you for the question.
Thank you.
Yeah, so we'll. I'm not sure who told you that it doesn't matter, and I can't imagine. Well, if it was one of my team, I will talk to them. But we can talk about it after.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Are there other? We've got another question coming.
Hi, I have a question about training and retaining young journalists. I think most of us started in small areas and worked our way up, and everyone wanted to aspire to work in the national centers in Canada, be Toronto and Ottawa. So how do you reconcile that local news is very important and that you're training and growing that talent base in local areas and sending the message to young journalists that it's fine to stay in Fredericton or, you know, Prince George, and not have to leave to make your mark or to do investigative stories?
It absolutely is important, and certainly, you know, we have quite a robust training department at CBC, and certainly on the digital shift, I mean, Brody Finland sitting here, he spent much of last year across the country doing, you know, digital literacy training in our local markets. And we're investing in different kinds of content creation locally, beyond sort of the daily news cycle. You know, some of our investigative investments in terms of, you know, we're hiring data journalists right now. We're positioning them out in the country. They're not all sort of sitting here in Toronto. So I think it's two things. One, we do train and we'll continue to train, but we also have to diversify opportunity, and we're beginning to do that with different kinds of investments locally.
If you're closing down smaller stations, and how does...
We're not closing down. You know, we're about to open a new station in London, Ontario, in April. So we're actually expanding our local footprint, and CBC has been doing that quite aggressively over the last several years. We're shifting, you know, how much resource we assign to different kinds of programming to try to create capacity to invest in digital. But expanding our local footprint, it absolutely is and continues to be a priority for CBC.
So
Oops, sorry.
Michael, if you want to ask a question, you have to go to the microphone. Even Mr. Volpe has to go to the microphone.
I thought I was worried you might start closing things down that before I got to the microphone.
You've got 8.5 minutes, Michael.
8.5 minutes.
But you don't get all 8.5 minutes, Michael.
Jennifer, my question relates to something you said, but it's to all three of you. You said to the first questioner that part of your responsibility is to make sure that news is relevant to the next generation of Canadians. My background is newspapers, and I know that there's an aging audience. It's somewhere up and around 50 or something like that. I'm curious as to all three of you can tell me, how do you go about making news relevant to next generations? What's that mean?
It's a couple of things. I think, one, you have to deliver to the places they consume it. We have a leader in our senior team, actually the manager of the Ontario region, who doesn't have a television, who still consumes video and audio content, but does it through their computer. So I think we need to recognize that there's a shift in where people go to consume things, and that means in some cases we change how we tell stories. But I also think we need to understand that, you know, what we define as a priority in terms of what we talk about also has to broaden. We heard a question earlier about the Indigenous community. Certainly, I get feedback, from women and families in terms of, you know, things that are relevant to, Canadians with families, and in terms of how much of an agenda that is in terms of the daily news agenda. So I think it's about both things. But what we found is, younger Canadians are interested in news. They're interested in documentaries. Bernie's here, and I'll remember when we were working together in radio, when we first started putting ideas in podcasting, we discovered a whole new, different generation of Canadians connecting that to that show via podcast than would ever have come to it on radio. So I think it is about the delivery mechanism, but I also think it is making sure that in our choices, and these are choices every day, that we're not only driving the news agenda, but we're making sure we're covering things that matter to Canadians in a broader context.
I think there are a couple of elements to this, and you as a newspaper guy know, first of all, that news consumption has always been related to age to some extent. And the good news is that everything that I see, both anecdotal and data-driven, is that this generation, this millennial generation, whatever names you want to give to it, is actually far more interested in news than any of us were when we were their age. I think there's actually no real debate. The second thing is they clearly have moved to this. I mean, that's the second point. It's not, they're not very interested most of the time in reading a printed newspaper, and they're not particularly interested in old broadcast models. So the question is, what do we do with all of this incredible journalism we do? What do we do with all this reporting we do? And how do we get it to these devices in ways that people will consume? So we spend a lot of time on this subject. We invented an app, which we call NPR One. I can stop for a minute if you want to download it.
You should. It's terrific.
I've got
and
it.
Frankly, it wasn't aimed for most of the people in this room, but it's actually been quite popular. But it's designed to put the content of public radio in America, but actually, and in fact, there is both BBC and CBC content on it. It is designed to present it in a way that younger people might actually want to engage with it. It's frankly a way to find out, because we know who's listening and how they're listening and what they're doing. So we use that to actually test what works, what doesn't work, what kinds of presentations work.
Is it giving you the numbers?
Oh, absolutely. It's giving us huge numbers. In fact, I'm very popular now in the podcast production business, because if I put your podcast on NPR One, I can give you data like about every single listener and how long they listened and what they liked and what they didn't like. I'm rolling in data. And I don't actually like data. I'm an old news guy who thinks that it should be the story, not the data. But the data is really useful. There is one other thing which you also know, but it just has to be modernized. So a lot of the people who read the newspapers got there through what I always call journalism gateway drugs. So for guys in particular, it was sports, right? We started to read the sports section, and then we started to read some. We happened to come across something else. So every news organization has to figure out what's its gateway drug. What's the thing that we do that actually will bring people in who we can then begin to introduce. So for us, I'm going to tell you a personal story. So I have, my wife is here and she knows this story. We have a now 20-year-old daughter, but when I went to NPR, I guess she was 17. She's a wonderful young lady. I think we've done a terrific job. Well, anyway, my wife's done a terrific job. But the honest to God truth is that we've dragged her all over the world and she's never really had the slightest interest in what either of us actually did for a living. And my wife's a journalist as well. So when I went to her and I said, you know, Louisa, I'm thinking of taking a new job. And she said, oh, okay, Dad, what are you going to do? And I said, well, I'm going to be the head of news at NPR. And her eyes widened and she looked at me and she said, Dad, that is so cool. And I'm thinking, this something's really not right here, because she loves me, but she's never called me cool. I mean, never, ever. And then she keeps going, she says, Dad, will you be in charge of Tiny Desk Concerts? Which, as at least some of you know, is this extraordinary hit rate music show we have. It's not even on the radio. It's mostly on YouTube. We have a digital version of it. And it's extraordinarily popular among 20-year-olds, basically, and 25-year-olds and stuff. It's great. And we actually do it at a tiny desk, literally, at a tiny desk, which is about 100 yards from my office. So I now get to hear it every time they do it. And I often pick up the phone, and I can hold it up, and my daughter can hear the concerts while we're doing them. But that's a gateway drug. And there's a whole audience of people. I don't even think all of them know that NPR is basically a news organization. I'm not sure what they know. But they begin to listen to other things. They begin to know that NPR is something they're interested in. And they begin, it's like the sports page. It's about music.
Michael, there's somebody behind you.
Yes.
If you don't mind.
Not at all.
I want to make sure we get some more questions.
And just for the record, Mike, I don't think your daughter actually called you cool. She just said that is so cool.
That's actually fair, right? You know? You guys are lucky to have somebody as sharp as this at the Globe and Mail.
Great discussion tonight, all of you. Thanks. About inclusiveness, and each have alluded to it. And Jennifer, you were talking about the restructuring of the national. But each of you have and you've talked about local being king, and I think CBC has a long way to go, but the idea. But the night of the US election recently, Wolf Blitzer, breathlessly concerned about why Wisconsin wasn't going Democrat. What's going on? What happened? Well, there was never any, something. There's going to be a lot of dissection of this, of course, but the early ones were early returns on this. Is there was no one in Wisconsin reporting. There was no one actually on the ground realizing that Clinton had pulled out all of her funding and all her advertising, all her ad buys. She had pretty much given up on Wisconsin. NPR suggests that they have local and they're on the ground. And Brexit, another example, there was areas, pockets that went leave that ought to probably, or were predicted never to do this. So, and it was never really reported prior. So it was all very reactive journalism. What happened? No one had the story up front. And I think a lot of it is because your national outlook is still London, it's still Washington, and it's still Toronto. Even if you are doing, you do have voices in the field, I think you're missing the fact that none of this is getting upwards and getting reported to the three big national centers. I'd like your reaction, on this.
Since it was my election, I'll start if you want.
Yeah. I think we're all happy to react.
Yeah.
Go on.
I agree with the issue you're raising. I don't quite agree with your analysis. I mean, I actually agree with your analysis. I don't quite agree with your reporting on it, actually. So I think you're right that the core issue of getting the work from the field into the thinking at the headquarters is the central question of 2016 in many ways. I think both public radio in the United States and a number of others actually did a much better job than is sort of understood. And in a way, that's part of the problem, too, that people don't know what Wisconsin Public Radio sent us or the pieces we actually did some pieces from Milwaukee in which one of our hosts rode the bus from the African-American neighborhoods in downtown Milwaukee. It was a bus line they had explicitly put in to take the African-American workers from downtown out into the suburbs to work at a big box store that had built out there. And that trip took you from a classic Democratic district to heavy Trump country. And all you had to do was listen to that piece, and you can get it now, and you knew you didn't know who was going to win, but you knew this was a real election. And to me, that's all we were supposed to do, frankly. I don't think we should have been predicting either side. There's clearly, there was a mindset that developed among a lot of journalists that they knew how the election was going to come out, and so therefore they were stunned that it didn't come out the way they thought it was going to come out. I think you're probably right that a lot of that was that they weren't listening closely enough to things that were actually being said. It's not that the information wasn't there, it's that they weren't absorbing it. They had a paradigm in their head, it wasn't breaking the paradigm. I think in many ways, 2016, both Brexit and the United States presidential election were the end of the first generation of the digital era. Because I think a lot of the problem was that people were so dependent on polls, and beyond polling, they were dependent on a kind of data thinking that was actually not good. It wasn't that it was even wrong, it wasn't accurate enough, it wasn't precise enough to get them the information they needed. You know, the polling, the national polling, by the way, was quite accurate. It accurately predicted the outcome of the election by votes. What it didn't account for was the complexity of the Electoral College in the United States. And that took boots on the ground, which people actually had but weren't paying attention to. So, I mean, I agree in broad measure with what you're saying, but I think there was a lot of reporting there. And I do think that the ability to get out of the mindset of headquarters is totally related to the earlier question. It's about inclusion. It's about virtual inclusion. It's about making sure that if you have a station in a rural part of the country, you're listening to the people at that station so you get the advantage of whatever they know, and you can merge it together with what else you know. So
so we have kind of blown past deadline, which usually means that I'm about to file. James, did you want to, you seemed...
I'm more than happy to. I also want to make sure that other people get the chance to ask their questions. So how do you want to do that?
So perhaps at the reception.
I think the point is, so you put your finger on what is clearly a not just a difficult question, but a really hard point, which is more than just the issue about how capitals dominate national coverage. How do you get news organizations to listen? That's more than just literally listening. It's actually organizationally, where are the people? How do you position them? In our case, what was really interesting was that the problem, if we're really sort of specific about it in the UK, actually wasn't in Brexit. It was in the 2015 election. So in the 2015 election, the polls were all leading to a coalition government. And the BBC has very strict rules about the way we report polls. Bluntly, we don't report polls. But the polling had such an impact on the way in which people were thinking about the election that they informed the questions that we asked and the packages that we made. And as a result of that, we missed two things. We missed the likelihood that actually a single party was going to end up with a majority. And we missed, organizationally, the fact that the southwest of the country was witnessing an amazing thing, which was the old coalition partners, Conservative and Liberals. The Conservatives just went for the Liberal Democrat vote. And there was an organizational issue there about how well were we listening to what was happening in the southwest. Funnily enough, when we got to 2016 and Brexit, what was really interesting is that we didn't predict which way it was going to go. Right? And our coverage, literally every day I would go in and say, we're not about the race, we're about the choice. Right? That has got to be our job. And as we go into this general election, I say the same thing. There is a mystery here, though, which is in an age when we have more data than ever, and we have more capacity to seek to understand people's behaviors, that you're seeing such difficulty in tracking in polling, and that news organizations like ours, for the good, are having to essentially put all of that information out of mind and start with something as if, you know, Mr. Gallup had never existed. It's a big change. But I think your question gets to something much deeper, which is not just where people are, but how we operate, how we listen.
So I will remind you, I'm sorry, but we are out of time. I will remind you that you will have an opportunity, all of you, to pester these three fine folks over glasses of wine.
He's waited so patiently, this poor gentleman. Can't he get a go?
No, I'm afraid not.
Turns out.
Sorry.
Thanks, Simon.
Oh, yes, she's also been waiting. So you've sat down too.
Yeah, We'll have time at the cocktail reception. As Simon said, you can do that with a glass of wine in your hand. We have been treated to a superb discussion this evening. On behalf of the entire audience, I want to thank our panel for their candor and their insights into what keeps them up at night and what they feel bodes well for the future. And our thanks to the always smart and funny Simon Haupt. This is why we keep bringing him back for the work. For the work he put into making this a discussion we can all benefit from. Before we head into the cocktail reception, now I'm part of the problem, I have a brief CJF commercial. We have some terrific events coming up, and we hope you'll join us. So on May 24th, we have a two-part evening at Roy Thompson Hall. We're joined by some of the world's most unrelenting investigative journalists, Amy Goodman, Naomi Klein, Glenn Greenwald, and Jeremy Scahill, for a conversation on the media's role in covering the chaotic Trump era. And the second discussion will feature Matt Taibbi, author of Insane Clown President and contributing editor to Rolling Stone, in conversation with David Walmsley, editor-in-chief of The Globe and Mail. And on June 8th, we're celebrating outstanding Canadian journalistic achievement at the CJF Annual Awards Gala. Our host this year is world-renowned journalist and globetrotter, the BBC's chief international correspondent, and her exotic accent is pure New Brunswick Acadian. She's one of our own, and she's the brilliant Lise Doucette. And GQ just dubbed him the realest man in fake news. It's CNN's Jake Tapper, who joins us for a tribute to his intrepid coverage of the U.S. election and the Trump presidency. Along with our other awards and fellowships, we're proud to recognize journalism trailblazer Jean Pelletier with our 2017 Lifetime Achievement Award. Jean is Senior Director of Television, Current Affairs, and Documentaries at Radio-Canada. He's had an extraordinary career as a reporter, editor, and producer in both print and broadcast, and his place in history is assured as La Presse's first permanent Washington correspondent. Pelletier scooped the world with his story about the six American hostages hidden by Ambassador Ken Taylor and his Canadian embassy staff in Iran. He's made a difference every step of the way in his career. At the helm of Radio-Canada's Le Point and Enquête, he produced reports that led to powerful social and legislative change in Quebec. So we look forward to highlighting his career and his achievements, his legacy in June. And I would now like to invite you to continue the conversation at the cocktail reception. Thank you so much for joining us and for supporting the CJF.
Shake it down now. Break house. tongue.